KBAL Portland, 90.7 the FM dial. You're listening to Talking Earth.
On Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
You are listening at KBO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. My name is Patrick Picard. I'm the host of, or the sometime host of The Talking Earth. And I have the good fortune to be in the studio with two of Portland's premier local poets who have been reading around town and publishing and owning cafes that people read at, among other things, for quite a while. Casey Bush is a Portland resident and has read at the Portland Poetry Festival, Seattle Poetry Festival, Red Sky, Artquake, Satyricon, the Crystal Ballroom, Powell's, Broadway Books, Cafe Lane, and many other venues. He has published 7 books of poetry. Feel free to start correcting me when I mess this up. Blessings of Madness, Jane's Bonnets, Kiss of the Apocalypse, Cannonball, Butt Crack, She's Not Afraid, or He's Not Afraid of Freud, excuse me. X.
Yes, you are.
Oh, wait, are you? Oh, I wasn't letting you correct me. Never mind. Now you can correct me all you want. Casey was the Oregonian's chess correspondent from 1987 to 1992 and received 3 awards from the Chess Journalists of America. He's the senior editor of the Bear Deluxe, which explores environmental issues through the literary and graphic arts. He has served as poetry editor, book reviewer, interviewer, and investigative journalist. His article, Apocalypse Found, Coltan, Cell Phones, and the Crisis in the Congo, was also featured on the political website Common Dreams and inspired Ryan Burns' sculpture and installation, Profane Relics and Ossuary of the Congo Mineral Wars. And I am holding his new book, Student of the Higba Campus, which this came out last year, did it not?
Sort of.
It's sort of in the... But you just finished. Yes, you...
Am I on there?
Yeah, you are.
So this is actually my 8th book of poetry. And it came out the cusp of the year. I didn't really have copies myself till February. And I've been on a book reading tour since then, once or twice or 3 times a month, and a bunch of times with Leanne. So,
yes,
a great time.
And Leanne Grable, is our other guest tonight.
Hello.
She is out there, and also correct me if I'm wrong, Leanne Grable, M.ED, and that's a Master's of Education, correct?
Correct.
Good. It's something I never got. Is a writer, illustrator, performer, and special education and language arts teacher in semi-retirement. In love with mixing genres and media, Grable has written and produced numerous spoken word multimedia shows, including The Lighter Side of Chronic Depression, Anger the Musical, and The Little Poets. Her poetry books include Flirtations, Lonesome and Very Quarrelsome Heroes, Short Poems by a Short Person, Bad Girls, a collection of flash nonfiction, as well as a theater piece, and most recently, Assisted Living, a chapbook of graphic prose poems. Grable has just completed Tainted Illustrated, a graphic stretched memoir, which is being serialized in The Opiate. Grable and her husband are the founders of Cafe Lena, a legendary Portland poetry cafe of the 90s. Grable's two daughters, some fabulous sons-in-law, a itty-bitty granddaughter Ophelia, and Bailey, the best dog ever. I just wanted to get to the dog part.
That's all true.
Yes. And so I think we're going to rotate. And Casey, you sounded like you wanted to get into a poem I kind of picked out already. Is that?
Sure. So Patrick has suggested that I read a poem that maybe relates to my possibly being the editor of the Bear Deluxe or one of the editors of the Bear Deluxe. And this is a poem that has an environmental theme. I'd like to see the Bear Deluxe, if it comes back to life one of these days, have a column that had a guided hike to various Superfund sites around the Northwest. And this is a poem about one that's out in the St. John's area. And it's still there. I mean, they haven't done that much about it. And you can visit it by just following this poem called Short Hike Through the McCormick and Baxter Superfund Site. Down from the Portway Tavern, meandering Edgewater Avenue, ignoring warning signs, do not enter, danger, danger, danger. Beyond barbed wire, around lock gate, overstuffed chair suffocates under ivy. At the base of an oak-shaded hillside, line of dead elms define the waterline, patches of dead grass poking out of an abandoned parking lot, dwarf maples stagger along railroad tracks, creosote grave bubbling over half century of telephone poles now entombed by a bentonite slurry mix designed to suck up pentachloral phenol, while arsenic, chromium, and zinc continue to slip between chemical scrubbing fingers. First identified decades ago, children in a waterhole burned by caustic acids. Today, a lone jogger quickly disappears down dusty trails. Yard service illicitly dumps lawn debris. Well-concealed tent city along the polluted river. Hollow-eyed men with yellow dogs fishing the old Mormon slough. Outside a graffiti-infested factory, rusted 55-gallon barrel in the ditch, cradling a blue heron nest, rookery abandoned by the trees.
So I had a question about that one, but...
Just take the number 4 out to St. John's. Yes. and just down below the Portway Tavern. You can find it.
So basically my question just admits that I haven't gone to St. John's enough in my life, even though I've lived here for 20 years.
It's a beautiful Superfund site. You'll enjoy it.
Yes. And on that note, Leanne, I think it's your turn to read from Gold Shoes.
But I think I'm going to start actually with a poem that Casey published in the Bear Deluxe. Since we're starting on the dark side, it's called Mandatory Anti-War Demonstration. It's the smacking, the flappy, fat-lipped gobbling, daft, rabid conquerors macerating lives like a human pig, no offense to the pig. It's the smash and the scorch of destruction, the shock of the smash. Imagine the scorch, imagine singed tissue, the hiss of moist tissue, the hiss and the burn of singed tissue. I think if you listen, you can just hear the grizzled whispers. Death's furling Cuban hat brim, way too tight on death's head, the final flash of fear, the anguish, the click of eyelids to extinguish, to be extinguished, the dank, acrid dust of obese war, such a dick with war's slick macho teeth shining with the gelatinous die, die war, die.
Wow, thank you. Bear to Lux.
Now we got the darkness out.
Excellent. Well, I would like to read another poem about a geographic part of Portland, but one that I urge you not to hike to. This is called Terwilliger Curves. Might as well have stayed at work late, ensnared by an anaconda just south of downtown, five zigzags in just a mile and a half, flashpoint of congestion, magnet for numbskulls, backup behind the pileup, defectively banked roadway mixed with a little precipitation, legally licensed charioteer in a pickup, halfway through a six-pack, dodging a three-quarter ton truck, careening into a coagulated passing lane littering metal, glass, and plastic debris along the motorway, bringing traffic to a standstill. Gawkers eye the spectacle and then create their own, already juggling an exasperated drive time. The purpose of commuting would seem to be simple, just a matter of getting to work and then home and back again, except in the middle of rush hour, when it can become a test of faith, demanding an expansion of the inner life force, imagining that domestic comforts are just around the corner as horsepower is turned out to pasture and drivers become unglued while trying to soar above the spiritual gridlock, invoking deep breathing yoga techniques, singing harmony to an intolerable mantra. Halfway between one bumper to the next, as the distance between car and curb cannot be measured in terms of righteousness or a Main Street egalitarian strain of justice obtained through petitions and initiatives and dispassionate elections monitored by international tribunals.
I like the spiritual gridlock. It makes me think of the scene in 8 and a half where the guy's dreaming and he's floating out of the traffic jam over everyone.
And you can do that every day, just driving to Tigard.
Yeah, you just won't float over everything. Man, you're ready for...
Yeah, from Gold Shoes, which is really a tribute to my mother and a little bit my father, but mostly my mother. Another hair story. At 95, she stopped coloring her hair, let it go gray, like gravel, like any old grandma. In her youth, my mother's hair, black as patent leather shoes, like my father's and my brother's and mine. Not my sister's. Hers was orange, like a crayon, eyes like fresh key lime pie. I was so jealous of her colors. But my mother's hair, black like Kalamata's, then auburn like tamari almonds, then brown, bronze, then golden blonde, then strawberry blonde, apricot, champagne, until last year, gray like a Weimaraner, round as a melon. Her caregiver set it in rollers. Every Saturday, she had a stand-up dryer. My mother's hair looked better than ever. It was puffy. It was always way puffier than mine, and I liked puffy. She liked puffy. My mother had twice as much hair as I ever will. Hmm.
Maybe this is a good time to mention that your book is divided into colors, and mm-hmm. that's the gray section.
Correct.
But it does have the painting above it is blue, which is nice.
Good.
I felt that was. I mean, it's a very colorful book. I love the drawings and the paintings within it, and the cover. And you were able to do the cover yourself, which
correct.
I wish that. If I ever actually did a real book, I would want to do that, and I'm sure I never would get the chance.
Oh, you never know. But yeah, I broke the chapters up into color, and the poems hopefully have a tone of the colors.
I think they do. Yeah. It was nice shading.
Thank you.
Casey, you have okay, you're ready.
I'm ready for another one. This is called Scat Singing on the Poop Deck. The flavors that meander down the center of my tongue lead to a trail through the pasture and into the woods. If I can taste fear in this roast beef sandwich, sacred cows must have sensed the hammer coming down. Fireflies catapult towards celestial bodies. Thoughts dance in the space between words. If you're asleep, I'm an insomniac watching movies. If you're awake, I'm pacing the hallway with a gun. Engagement ring lost down the drain, washing dishes. Frustrated locksmith pop hinges off the door. Bird tracks in the snow or a mathematical formula designed to turn the entire light spectrum into white noise. Waves in redwood burl cast from the cries of great horned owls. Dreams just before dawn remembered throughout the day. My brain wallows in a short-circuiting electric chair that can also serve as a composting chamber pot. Broken fingers caught in an unforgiving cookie jar poised above this frozen keyboard of misunderstanding. If death was just a divine evil, the gods would not prefer eternity. To pass through this world, the world must pass through you.
Hmm. I like that one. Death was just a divine evil. Reminds me of Lord Dunsany, actually. Which, I don't know, just a weird... He wrote an entire book called The Gods of Pagana, and it's about... And I'm going on a massive tangent, and I'll need to shut up in a minute, but the Gods of Pagana was all about how the gods didn't like dying, and they all acted like rather cavalier, but they were made-up gods that no one's ever heard of before, like Mung. But it's totally fit that one. So, Leanne, can you get me out of this?
Yeah. Yes. Another one about my mom. I think you have to be a woman to understand the struggle that daughters and mothers go through about hair, A, and clothing, B. This is kind of about clothing. Not another shoe poem. She matched. Top half matched, her bottom half matched, her head, waistline, thighs, calves, belt, shoes, purses, jewelry matched, clasps matched. It was deliberate, everything, well put together, everyone said so. Dozens of lipsticks, hundreds of tones, 90 minutes easy every day, getting ready, putting on face, getting hair done every Friday, fingernails, toenails. She had such lovely feet. Triple A width, slender and pale, yes, her feet look like doves. Funny, she was always trying to give me her shoes. I can't wear them, I'd say. I've been saying it for years. My feet are round and stubby like potatoes. She would always laugh, big. In her closet, many stacks of skinny shoes in original boxes, carefully labeled. Kelly green heels, navy buckle flats, cherry red Keds, fancy silver pumps. Every letter was a capital, slanted, sometimes with a serif. She had a drawer, spilled with scarves, exquisite fluid angels. Yet her body, the opposite, choppy, restless, detached. Her fingers were cold, sharp, her bracelets jangled. And then my daughters, thank God my daughters, they're here like fires. They flare, they flared over the both of us, warmed us, kissed us both in time on the mouth, my daughters, the good queens, they lifted us in time, cradled us, spun us, my daughters, they rocked us, rooted, my mother and me.
Hmm. Yeah.
I do have a poem about my mother, but I'm not going to read it because I just can't compete with Leanne's poems.
No, but that's okay.
Let me read a short one. And this is called Delusions of the Sane. That the sky is blue, that blood is red, that the needle of the compass points north, that facing up to problems is the solution, that guns are needed to protect the home, that the police are sworn to serve and protect, that advertising is a superior form of graffiti, that the war on cancer is being won, that the war on terror is a form of cancer, that power tools define masculinity, that strip malls mix business and pleasure, that understanding mathematics will eventually add up, that the newspaper is new each and every day.
This, you're listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard. You're listening to KBO Portland, and I'm here in the studio. You just heard Casey Bush reading from his book, Student of the Hippocampus. And next you're going to hear Leanne Grable, who may or may not be reading from her new book, Gold Shoes.
I will be. But now we're moving on to my father, who had a much larger footprint in many ways. In fact, when my mother died and we met with the rabbi so he could get information for the funeral, everybody kept talking about my father. And finally, my younger daughter said, "We're talking about Nanny. We're not talking about Poppy." But he kind of hogged. Anyway, my generous caller. I was emailed a poem the other day by David Lehman. I liked it. I printed it. I put it in my pocket. There was an image, a piano. Quote, rank and file, black and white. A good way to describe a piano, I thought. Then I went to see my father. He was sleeping in his deathbed, a tube up his nose, a tube down his throat. It had a headlamp, a camera, a feeler. What was snorting down there? Everybody was asking. All the busy doctors sifting through the ashes, thousands of fat cigars, towers of salami, their casings stacked like undershirts, vats of butter and margarine, vats of chicken fat, bullets of anger, dunes of anguish, the green gravy of disappointment. Last time I saw him, I wore a generous collar, expensive white blouse, ruffled, liquid. It fit like a bath, but I felt like a turtle or a cowgirl. I sat on his deathbed and stared. I stared dry-eyed, lock-jawed, a vast devastation. I put my hand on his arm, mottled with blotches, hip touching hip, sat on his deathbed, still, for the first time, read him the poem by David Lehman. He smiled. He liked it. He liked the piano. His eyes closed. His life force was eddying down the final drain. He was smiling. Days later, he died, alone. I was driving north on I-5. My mother was driving south on Pershing, heading to the cleaners, picking up that fancy blouse.
Here's another poem that reflects my interest in science, my devious interests in science. It's called Human Phoneme Project. Starts with a quote from Andre Breton that goes, "A monstrous aberration makes people believe that language was born to facilitate their mutual relations." If you say that a single cell of a plant or the stump of an amputated limb has the potentiality of reproducing the whole, when the message is a mess, while an egg with a leg is listed in a catalog of corpses, things are not so clear. But when you talk about amino acid building blocks, twisted strands of communication, substituting phonemes for proteins, crippled freedom, liberating falsehood, intertwined in an act of faith, then I get an idea. A central organ growing backwards into dictionary roots drawn from hungry oceans of sound, tides suck rivers off tabletops, rupture utterance frames of acoustic reference facing the open casket, mumbling mass, mouthing mantras awake at the wake. Scientists join ranks with linguists as graphemes replace fruit flies. Twisted helix, mutating morphemes, breeding lexicons in test tubes, mosaic of 1-2 letters, snapshots, fetal, alphabetic, skeleton, reflection, proto-tongue, not so much spoken as whistled, spit, grunt, bark, snarled, sung, ba ba da, wit, hu, ti, wo, wo, mm.
Have we escaped the darkness yet? It's all dark where I am, actually. People can't see it because we're in a radio, but... Sometimes things don't work at KBU and the lights are kind of off in my section of the room. But you ready to go?
I am ready to go.
Okay.
I'm realizing how different Casey, our poems are so different. Mine are all about my family.
Well, that's the structure of the books themselves.
Right. I mean, that's fine. One more about the father. Hat story in five parts. Number one. Now I wear his blonde beret, the one he wore right before the end, with his turquoise string tie. A French cowboy caught in the holding pen outside Death's Rodeo, a convalescent hospital where he died with all those one-legged men, roaring, snoring, crazed women who growled, brains like cheese, short, quick nurses from Manila. Then he died. Number two, I found his Lions Club pin, so I pinned it on the edge of his champagne beret, rides right above my eyebrow, where he kissed me, rare times, like a whisper, in the 50s. Gray fedoras in the 60s, white Stetsons, then berets in the 70s, berets in the 80s, silly golf hats in the 90s, kerchiefs like Gary Cooper, ascots like David Niven, groupings of medallions like Elvis going down. Number three, my father's dead now almost 14 years. I never wear his red beret. It's the size of a pizza, makes me feel like a clown with a pie on my head. But I wore it to his funeral because I remember him in it more than the others. Number four, I took all his hats. Nobody wanted them. Mostly berets. In the end, the white one, the green one, the blue one, the red one, the champagne. Number five, no, there weren't any black ones, no gray ones, no brown. Those are the colors of my husband, tweed tams. No, there weren't any tams. No, my father, he wasn't a tam man. No tweeds, no plaids. Jews don't really wear that much plaid. No, I did not marry my father.
Here's a dad poem.
Okay, good.
And then I'm going to follow it with an uncle poem, because this one's short. So it's called Precipitation. Okay. That other day, listening to the rain, thought I heard my father's voice falling between Morse code drops, long dead, but not erased. Audio postcard from the beyond, saved message on the phone. Just calling to say hello. Goodbye. This is called Uncle's Monkey. When my uncle came to live with us, it seemed to me that he had just gotten out of jail and was on parole for some ghastly crime. Perhaps it was the smell of his aftershave or the way he burped up dinner and read every article in the paper with his lips moving silently over each word. But I tried to be polite, and the days passed slowly without incident. I watched with suspicious curiosity as my mother's brother paced back and forth in front of the bedroom window, bored with his life among relatives, thinking perhaps about visiting the local tavern while looking vacantly into the backyard where our dog was tied up to the garage, who in turn paced back and forth thinking of the neighbor's cat. That children should become aged so quickly, unduly complicating their nascent minds when things are so difficult for adults among whom they live but don't understand, unable to anticipate the memory of better times to come when the moon won't smell like rotten cheese and Einstein will be free of relative uncertainty. The window was shut, the curtain closed as I whispered prayers under my pillow, hoping that nobody but God could hear my thoughts. Although my uncle's room was at the end of the hall, we all live within substantial components of each other's universe. What I do remember is climbing onto the garage roof and looking into his room like a burglar in my own house, scanning my uncle's suitcase for prosecutorial evidence, eyeing it for guns and stolen goods or large amounts of cash, while finding only neatly folded shirts and pants and a few neckties. Quickly sliding down the rusty drain pipe, I fell to the ground and got up before the dog could lick my face.
See, that's more of a Leanne poem.
I've got relatives. Leanne's not the only one with relatives.
Okay. Leanne, do you have another one to...
Yeah.
And then I'm going to have a little break to promote a couple events.
I have two shortish ones about marriage. Now that we talked about my mother and my father, and now we'll talk about a little marriage a little bit. Marital clamp. Sometimes the jaws of a marriage grow tight, so tight they clamp, industrial strength. Yes, this happens, every marriage. And if the marriage says it doesn't, this cramping, it's lying. You can verify. Is the TV on? Is the husband drinking scotch, neat, both bellies lying soft on their groins like a baby? Are their bellies like a baby lying soft on their groins? Is she eating the fat on the meat? Is she knitting thick textural scarves by the dozens? Do her thumbs ache? Do her top teeth now fit like a tongue in the groove of her bottom? Did she chisel the groove with her clench while he slept? Are her jaw bones too loud? Are they louder than the snoring? Can you hear them while she's driving down Powell to work? Does he turn on some old Leonard Cohen? Does she turn on some old Leonard Cohen without knowing? Is that good? Is the marriage okay? Rules of marriage. Soften fists. Straighten toes. Flex feet. Relax feet. Twist and shout. Unhump toes. Soften fists. Keep control of own damn socks. Shit freely. Close the door. Twist and shout. Have manners. Groom well. Be elegant. Point upwards. Point outwards. Open legs. Toes out. Flex feet. Twist and shout. Clip your toenails. Open chest. Allow eyebrows. Untuck blankets. Stop obeying. Laugh at eyebrows. Try obeying. Tame the basement. Clean the toaster. Rid crap. Surprise each other. Unhood everything. Surprise each other. Trust the children. Copy the dog. Lick the husband.
Wait a minute. We got a little cosmic coincidence licking the dog, right?
Yeah. No. That's what Doug, yeah.
The longer Leanne and I read together, actually, the more alike we become.
Yes.
On that note, actually, while both of you were on tour together, I mean, how many places did both of you read at? I saw both of you at Broadway Books, but the tour went all over Oregon.
Went to Newport to the Visual Arts Center, had a beautiful reading with the sun setting as we read. Went to Eugene Barnes and Noble, Black Hat out on MLK, and another read through on Mississippi.
Yeah.
So a few places.
And so now Leanne is going to go start a tour with
John Dooley.
Is that a tour or just a reading?
Well, it's a short tour. We're going to read it on September 16th at a winery, Friends of John's in St. Helena, California, called the Barron's Winery. And then the next day we're going to read at the Sacramento Poetry Center on September 18th. And then I'm without John, although I did invite him, but he said he's not library material. I'm reading at the Livermore Library in Livermore, California, where I will be spending the night with another valedictorian from Amos Alonzo Stagg Senior High School in Stockton, California, who I have not seen in 49 years.
Wow.
So that's going to be, anyway.
So John Dooley thought he wasn't library
material? I know. He goes, no, I'm not library material. So, yeah.
It's great. He has so much circumspection.
Right.
Well, that sounds like a good tour. If I had the opportunity, I'd go try to check those out. But there are no readings in town with in Portland.
We've exhausted Portland, and this is the height of it here on your show.
But Leanne Grable and John Dooley in Portland.
No, we don't have anything set up here.
Oh, okay, well maybe something will happen.
Yeah,
but so on the note of readings in Portland, this Sunday, August 26th, please tell me I got the date right. Yes, August 26th. The Hour That Stretches is going to happen again at Ford Food and Drink and Southeast 11th to 12th and Division. It's the MC is Edward Morris, who's actually I'm in a writing group with, and he's published a bunch of fiction, won several, like he was up for a Pushcart Award once, and I respect him a lot as a Lovecraftian writer, and he's going to read a chapter from his new novel I Am Legion, which I believe he has I'm not sure if that is the one that he's actually signed a contract for, but he is publishing a novel pretty soon. Ducky Graham, YT Cheng, who's a science fiction writer, Kelly Baker, and bizarro writer Garrett Cook are also going to perform. and that's this Sunday, August 26th. September 3rd, the last stand at Wildwood Saloon, which used to be Tony's Tavern, is going to be happening. And they say, I think they claim they start at 7, but maybe go by at 8. And lasts all night, just about. It's featuring Scott Yeager. And September 5th at Literary Arts, and I didn't write down the time. It's probably 7 p.m. I'm not sure. Insight, Queer Writers Read, and I think that's a feature reading, but there could be some. It might be an open mic too. Go ahead and check them. Look that up online. But that's also happening September 5th. Casey, do you have any readings coming up, or are you exhausted?
I'm taking a poetry vacation.
That's very sensible. That's sometimes.
I know, it's been a fun run. We've had I did some readings with Dan Raphael. I went to Olympia, where the publisher is, that type of thing. So it's
cool.
Been having a fun time.
And I think we're done with the commercial, so I think we can get back to the actual poetry.
Oh, I just want to say one thing about Edward Morris and the hour that stretches, because he invited me to be on the show on September 30th, but I canceled 2 days because of my daughter's getting married like 5 days later. But he said, well, I'm going to set up a thing where it's like young slam poets versus old Leanne. He wants to kind of do a dual thing.
Well, he does
he
a lot.
Said it just like that?
Well, not really, but kind of.
Well, yeah. I mean, I went to the last one, and it's very disparate. The writers he gets in, he brings in the read. They're very different writers. But the thing is that the good thing about that is that means that the audience is very disparate too, and you actually have a site. It was a very crowded Ford got really crowded, and I was very impressed with the. I hadn't been to one in a while. I had read at one when he was at the Jade Lounge, and there was a sizable crowd then too, but that was a little more more closer to the kind of stuff he writes, instead of like this one was like Nathan Tompkins read, a number of other poets read, and it was very disparate. Like one, I wrote the names of a couple of them I didn't know were amazing actually. So it's well worth reading there if you get the chance, even if he is going to like, I don't know. I'm probably not the last person to promote a slam, because I have I had the worst record, like -8 or something before they learned that they couldn't do negative numbers in the poetry slams in Portland.
Well, I'm not a slam poet.
No, not a, yeah.
But I'm a performance.
Yes, poet, yeah. But you can perform, yeah. But but you should, if you get the chance, you should read at his event. Okay.
I will.
It's a lot of fun.
Indeed.
Anyway, Casey, if you want to steal away, like end the commercial and.
All right, let's have another poem.
Yes.
So Patrick amazed me and read my book. And I am so complimented. Did you even read the essay at the end, the Blind Poets essay?
You mean
Borges, Creeley, all that stuff?
Oh God, I just finished. Oh my, we're not reading that part, are we?
No. I'm just trying to show you what a great poetry host you are. That you don't have people on here, but you read their books. You cultivate them.
I do my best.
So why don't you choose my next poem? You were mentioning a few before we got on.
And hopefully you already read a couple that I asked for, three of the ones. Let's try Patchwork Heaven. I'm going to have to say, though, about the... I love the essays at the back, but I don't think we should read them on air.
No, not at all.
But I think people should totally buy this book just to read those, because finding that out about Creeley, oh my God.
Well... it's a true story.
I'm going to stop there. But Patchwork Heaven would be great if you want to read that one.
And remind me where I'm at. Oh, I see.
Page 84.
Okay. So this is actually the poem about my mom. And the Patchwork Heaven is about a conversation my mother and I had a number of times about the origin of heaven and hell. She's been gone for 18 years now. And in the 90s, once she retired, she started making quilts, and she hand sewed them. She made one a year, and the one she made for me was called a Triple Irish Chain. It was black and white and red, very geometric. Within the black and white and red, there were these little yellow squares that had stars on them with little sayings, and the sayings are in the poem. So this is Patchwork Heaven, Triple Irish Chain for Carol. Some suspect they are not stars at all, but devastating holes in the fabric of a seamless universe. Starlight, star bright. Just as the Bible fails to mention hell, heaven may too be an invention of the church. Wish upon a falling star. Only when the sun is set and the moon eclipsed can I dip my ladle into the broth of the Milky Way. First star I've seen tonight. So much so that our belief in a brilliant, distant reality can cast clouds over a locally coveted beauty. Starry, starry night. And maybe there aren't any stars nor any substantial holy hell, but then where does all that light really come from? I wish I may, I wish I might. Curtain call in the land of Oz. Angels stare from behind the fence, laser beams through the knot holes illuminating the construction site. Star of wonder, star of light.
So she believed that heaven was an invention of the church, or is that...
No, heaven and hell are an invention of Plato.
Yeah.
And the Christians, you know, to gather the masses, had to incorporate the Greek pagans, the German pagans, you know, all that stuff. And so a lot of what we view as Christianity is really, you know, usurped from other areas. I mean, well, come on.
You know, like, for instance, that Christmas is the day of Saturnalia, isn't it?
No, Santa Claus is Jesus, and I think you just got to get that straight.
Okay. All right, Leanne. Okay. I think it's Leanne's turn. Yeah. I've had enough of Leanne.
Speaking of churches or Christianity, this is really a poem that's kind of a letter to Christians. Would close. I've always been jealous of you. Jealous of your hair, your height, your legs, your feet, your eyes, the green in your eyes, the blue. Jealous of your red satin skirts, your purple satin skirts, your soft velvet bodices, tartans, and tinsel. I was jealous of your creamy, your chenille, yes, your Easter. I coveted those hats, those big straw hats like a garden umbrella. Roses and lilies and daffodils, giggles of baby's breath, snapdragons, light shows of ribbons, so jealous of your five-pointed stars, your swags of wee lights, all that twinkling, oh, jealous of your soft buxom mothers who baked and who fried, oh, I wanted those pork chops, so jealous of your angels and strange explanations. But I was not jealous of your fish sticks, forget it. And frankly, your churches, forget it. Admittedly gorgeous, beyond belief, so to speak. But I'm allergic to churches. They give me an itch. They make me feel just like I'm wearing wood clothes, gigantic, rough wood clothes. It feels awful.
And the great thing about being an old poet is that you have the opportunity to experience this next poem, which is called Second Puberty. Starts with a quote by Yeats, "The tragedy of sexual intercourse is the perpetual virginity of the soul." During the earliest millennium, premature aging was noted among eunuchs of Egyptian pharaohs. Just as castration of roosters leads to atrophy of their red combs, mystery of aging hidden within the scrotum. It was the Greeks who established that the difference between the gods and mere mortals was in the cojones, a fact bemoaned by a besotted Apollo, too inebriated to properly get it up, while Zeus gathered Rocky Mountain oysters, consuming a steady diet of bull testicles in preparation for the rape of Europa. In the heroic epoch of exploration, conquistadors driven by visions of gold and sexual enslavement falsely pursued their futile quest to the ends of the earth, seeking eternal life in a perpetual new world, until Ponce de Leon had to be satisfied sipping an aphrodisiac tea drawn from the Bahamian love vine, phytogenic substitution for his elusive fountain of youth. Still today, in our fading patriarchal age, leather-clad geezers straddle motorcycles, rattling their balls on the way to the saloon so that they might exercise a death grip on the pool cue, eight ball in the side pocket, dreaming of the climatic ocean sunset observed from a clawfoot bathtub, old codger with his dewy gland waiting for the prescription to kick in, hoping to stay out of the emergency room with a hard-on that just won't stop, even after the fatal cardiac arrest.
All right.
The only thing I was gonna say is, like, that's back to being a commercial sort of.
It's exactly.
Well, it's about a commercial.
Yes.
Speaking of age, the enemy is my age. Yeah. Ayman al-Zaari, al-Qaeda mucky muck. He's only 6 weeks older than I am. Damn, that's depressing. I thought I would be much younger than the enemy. Didn't you? And is that what I look like? A landscape of dunes, sling of chin hairs, vast forehead like Asia, too much forehead for a face, and that chaotic corrugation of veins. Me and Ayman, bulby noses, shiny snouts, long thick sniffers with spines veering right, nostrils hidden. But his eyes, they're like old bullet holes, flat, black, mean like ire or cancer. My eyes are much lighter. They're brown, golden brown, like a California foothill or a caramel pudding. My eyes have windows. They let in light. Right? Mm.
The new world is growing old. The restaurant at the top of the Eiffel Tower proved too heavy for that structure, so was auctioned off, shipped piece by piece to New York City, and reassembled in order to entertain a view of another French architectural creation. The true precedent was set when London Bridge deserted the Thames, retired to Arizona. The future holds something for everybody. Negotiations are presently underway to welcome Rome's Colosseum into the eye of the Pentagon.
Speaking of war, the War of 2001. So this is an old poem, but it just seems appropriate. And Patrick suggested I might want to read it. Yeah, it was written. Well, yeah. Go ahead.
I guess I picked war poems, I guess.
Yeah, well. And so it was written September 13th, 2001, when I truly felt like, as a poet, it was mandatory that I write something about what happened. I told my new therapist. She was concerned I was not feeling the tremendous storms of grief, the bolts of grief, the glut, the spate, the jolt, the coats of grief. I told her, what? I wake up early every morning and make a stack of hotcakes for the wolves of fear, and then I sit an hour feeling. Hardback wooden chair, first cold, then hot, then cold, my legs folded under like paper clips. I sit there staring at all the pictures like gray checkers in the New York Times with the catchy headlines, all the women, the desperate women with their messy ponytails and lustrous fingernails that clutch their largest photos of their smiling sons and men now dust to dust in pretty hands like flags of surrender. Cry, I said, I cry, just cry and cry, my old knees screaming for relief. I can't release them, make immediate plans for yoga. My new therapist smiled warmly with her ample, crooked mouth and then adjusted her large stomach. Though I tried to nod, I stared. Good, she said, that's good. Next time, I thought, I have to tell her I've been crying just this way for years, the tears embedded in my sad and ancient code. But still, I say, my God, this time I say we've really done it. Etched the membrane, set the branding. Look, it's on the faces. Even babies look like scarecrows, ankles sharp and poking out their bright white shoes. I mean, the white men cry. That's big, I say. Next time I'm going to have to tell her only seconds can I actually feel each day, or I might die like them by the horrible weight of it. Oh, I felt so strong at first. I shouldered quite a bulk of it, but then my muscles burned, my scalp grew tight. Oh, Gandhi, can you hear me? Gandhi, Can you hear me?
So as a surrealist, I am drawn to irony, but at times we need to put those tools away, tell the truth to the face. And this next poem is from an experience I had in the middle of the country. Now, we live in a big country. That's a good thing, and that could be a bad thing. And there are certain places in the middle of the country that you can see both coasts, and you can see the whole place. And this is called Memorial Day at the Little Bighorn. At the edge of the Great Plains, beneath a western big sky, just off I-90, halfway between Billings and Gillette, through a toll booth up from the Crow Casino, rest stop without picnic tables, gift shop run by Boy Scouts, public address system announces the next lecture in 15 minutes. Solemn menfolk holding the hands of their wives and children, mostly grizzled white guys, but also a few Lakota sporting gray ponytails. Every truck in the parking lot with bumper stickers supporting the troops. Behind the visitor's center, on a covered patio overlooking Last Stand Hill, an overly enthusiastic ranger dressed in green camo relives the massacre. How could such a well-armed cavalry be overrun by heathen savages? Only military cemetery in the world with tombstones placed to mark where each soldier fell. Rounded marble monuments lie scattered down the treeless hillside, dry coulee once awash with red blood, today covered by yellow grass filled with buzzing locusts. Signs caution tourists, beware of snakes. Stay on paved pathways to prevent further erosion. Use of metal detectors prohibited in search of battlefield artifacts. Sue in the audience asks, and so where are the dead warriors? Our guide points to the far side of the road, a stone circle 6 feet deep, topped by an iron sculpture depicting warriors on horseback, inscribed with a list of names and a culturally sensitive 21st century narrative etched into marble about the clash of nations. Europeans thirsting for gold and manifest destiny, nomads striving for an existence not burdened by the ownership of land. Just imagine Custer's surprise, our host continues, gesturing to the river below, when he came upon a city of teepees under the cottonwoods, Cheyenne and the Oglala, Sans Arc and the Brule, Blackfeet and Unkpapa, not just Custer's last stand, but also that of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. Just imagine burial sites for those first peoples who died in revenge, from Big Hole to Buffalo Gap, from Stronghold to Wounded Knee, a genocide that could not be contained by this entire valley. Back in the parking lot, I noticed yet another more substantial graveyard occupying an irrigated green lawn set below a line of pines filled with white granite squares in neat columns and rows, evenly spaced so that a mower could be driven between. National Cemetery designed for an additional legion of patriotic souls. Children of Montana who served their country overseas in Germany and Japan, in Korea and Vietnam, in Iraq and Afghanistan, driven into frenzied murder by rallying cries echoing the memories of the Alamo and Custer, the Maine and Lusitania, Pearl Harbor and the World Trade Center. And it was then that I imagined, just beyond those unmarked burials of Native Americans suggested by the uniformed storyteller, yet another invisible martyr's boneyard extending all the way to the Continental Divide, filled with victims of wars fought throughout Asia and Europe, a necropolis so vast and endless that everyone on this earth are either dead victims or living witnesses, pushing up dandelions or placing flowered wreaths, without time enough to wait until the next sun rises, without lifespans to spare until a blue moon falls out of the sky, without the patience to pause until pale faces and red skin are the same color, as this life is too short and precious, and there are more important things to celebrate than the crusades of brave warriors and noble soldiers.
Go ahead, Leanne.
Sunday, 3:40 in the morning. Hush. I changed the time, by the way, if you're noticing in the book. It's Sunday, 3:40 in the morning. It's the opposite of blasts, the opposite of bombings, the opposite of any kind of offensive. No greed, no roar, no screech, no Trump. On Sunday at 4 a.m, I am up, as always, the rat race on recess, the motors are off, the heater is brushing its teeth and deep stretching, dust sambas with fruit flies, the sofas are ironing their skirts, snores and farts, sloppy giants are bumbling about, newspapers soft shoe up onto the porch in their angular jackets, they are thin as Fred Astaire, no one would conceive of mowing his lawn, no leaf blowers, it's the opposite of blowhards and trucks, nothing self-conscious, not even Sunday, usually so cloying. Soft bakers shape scones, the loveless weep evenly into silk pillows, the damaged are stalking their prey, yes, the wolves howl, yes, eerily, far, far in the distance, like out in Akron, Ohio, where my friend Jan is probably sleeping. I mean, that girl could sleep through anything. I was always so jealous of that.
And here's what I'm doing at 3:40 a.m. This is called I Smoked a Spider. It was dark. I was drunk, probably already stoned. Didn't need another hit. Like I said, dark, drunk, stoned. Picked up what I thought was dried bud, but certainly it could well have been an insect. Felt the same packed into the pipe, a fly, a wasp, a moth, a midge. In any event, properly ignited, set on fire and sucked up. Thought it was some dead leaves. A thorn, a thistle, an incandescent straw, but tasted like holy hemp. Could have been anything, maybe even a spider, accented by a gooey pipe residue. No use scraping the screen for a corpse. Medicinal moss, fern, fungus, mold, husk, larvae, seed, pupae, pulp, algae, bong fodder clogging up the old windpipe. Although upon reflection, maybe it was a spider, illuminated by flame as it danced within a blaze, interdigitating eight-legged arachnid-like bossa nova, quickstep, samba, paso doble, slowly stimulated by heat, quickly reduced to ash. Yes, I may well have smoked a spider or some such sentient being, animal, vegetable, mineral, stone, paper, scissors, following the long-legged blonde straight down the rabbit hole, gobbled up by obligatory prescriptions, unexpected tax refunds, highway lined with salad bars, and the fumes of flesh casting clouds of doubt upon preconceived notions about the allegedly vast differences between the plant and animal kingdoms, ultimately satisfying and oh so smooth, got high while an insect did its last heel and toe, got me thinking, maybe it's the next big buzz. Yes, I guess I actually smoked a spider.
That was Casey Bush reading a poem about how he may or may not have smoked an arachnid, and reading from his book, Student of the Hippocampus. And Leanne Grable is going to read next. We have just a couple minutes left. Leanne's
it's just a teeny little poem.
Well, you could read a couple, maybe.
A couple teenies. Yeah. Pink, how about a couple of the color ones? Chapter one is called Pink. The wink and whisper, glint, the grin, the blistered lip, the skin before the scar and after, feathers scent, tenders hue, before the rub, the whip, the raw, before the rough, the round, the sweets, the pulp as baby, red as baby, pain as baby. And how about, hold on, blue. Fathom blue, fathoms of blue, spectrums of blue, sapphire, cerulean, clarity, honesty, density, pockets of droop, dirty workers in denims, exhausted, the tailors, the toilers, the maids, and the maintenance men. Oh, swim into it, blue, swim into the dismal, the naughty, unbutton, the bruises, the choking, sink into it, dive, now get out, now envision the order, tiny buttons like spines down her blouse, prissy lips, fathom proof and protection, calming chords in minor progressions, fathom slanted, folded anger, fathom stacks, fathom flocks, fathom meadows of cornflowers, oh, magnificent sky, fly right into it, aquamarine, float right into it. Float. Come on. Float.
You have been listening to Talking Earth with our guests, very fortunate guests to have, Leanne Grable and Casey Bush, and their new books. I think you can find them at bookstores just about everywhere. Gold Shoes and Student at the Hippocampus. And please stay tuned for Gremlin Time.
Thank you, Patrick.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which starts September 21st of this year and runs through May of 2019, all staged at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. And for the first time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering season ticket packages at prices below single show rates, either online or at the door. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.